Our gospel lesson today is really a continuation of the Beatitudes that we began to hear from last week. He says to those who are suffering and who are derided, "You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world." Be encouraged, in essence. You are doing the right things. You are blessed. The Beatitudes say to those who follow the way of the prophets and of Jesus, "You have chosen the way of honor now. Live into it. Don't put your light under a bushel basket. One, it's a fire hazard. Two, nobody sees it." But these verses and the Beatitudes only make sense when they're understood as something that we actually live into and do. If they're just words, they mean very little. Like James, the brother of Jesus, said, "Show me your faith without works, and I will show you my faith by my works." And this is where it all begins to unravel, actually, for us. Because we like to imagine ourselves as the good guys and the good women, the ones who are right and righteous. After all, we have chosen the way of honor. We are the salt of the earth and the light of the world. The problem is that the ones who, to our way of thinking, are the bad guys in Matthew's gospel actually turn out to be the good guys, the Pharisees. The Pharisees were the ones who had chosen the path of honor. In fact, they were out of the same path and way of Jesus. They had chosen not to become accomplices to the Roman Empire, nor to the rich and powerful who couldn't make it into the temple to offer proper sacrifices. That was the path of the Sadducees, who were the compromisers, who were the ones that made peace with the Roman powers that be and with Herod, the king of the Jews. The Pharisees had insisted on keeping the faith pure and doing that in your own home. As Jesus himself said, "Whoever does and teaches the law will be called great in the kingdom of heaven." And the Pharisees would have completely agreed with this. They would have nodded with Jesus and saying, "Yeah, you've got it right." But in the remainder of chapter 5, we hear Jesus say this: "Unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees," which implies that their way of life isn't enough, "you will not enter into the kingdom of heaven." And to drive home his point, Jesus says repeatedly about them, "You have heard it said, but I say to you," for example, "even if you have looked at a woman with lust in your heart, you have committed the very act of adultery." Jesus, you see, isn't coming to abolish the law or the prophets. In fact, he's coming to make it nearly impossible to fulfill the law and the prophets. He's elevated it to a standard above anything that we would do ourselves. It's as Michelangelo said in our opening statement in our bulletins, "It's not the problem that we set our sights too high, it's the problem that we set our sights too low and actually achieve our goals." We often see the Pharisees, therefore, as bad guys, as people who are strict law-abiding rule followers, but they are criticized by Jesus, which doesn't help matters even. But the truth is, almost every one of us, since the beginning of time, has been a Pharisee in one way or another. I am a Pharisee. My family background has been always to do what is right. From my earliest memories, I was schooled to do the right thing, not to disappoint my grandmother or grandfather, who were very religious, or my parents. We were churchgoers, generation after generation, raised in the Presbyterian Church. We were serious about doing the right thing each and every day. And no one was harder on us than we were on ourselves when we failed to live up to what we expected the life of Christ to be like. But there is a big problem when you try to live a pure and righteous life. And the first thing that you'll notice is that you can't live up to it, no matter how hard you try. The harder, in fact, that you try to live that righteous life, the more you will fail. It's not just a personal thing, because we all fail. Our judgment is always flawed, or at least tinged by self-interest and a tiny bit of hypocrisy from now and then. When life is about doing all of the right things, when life is about trying to not make a mistake ever, it's almost impossible not to disapprove of those who don't do the right things. And that's what I mean when I say we're complicated by this notion that my right thing is always the right thing and your right thing is always the wrong thing. And finally, you'll find that you are never, ever good enough if you try and live this way. You will always be disappointed in yourself, and it will make it nearly impossible for you to love yourself, much less love anybody else, because you'll constantly be self-critical, trying to do better, trying to be something that you cannot achieve. So Jesus says, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you're hypocrites, for you lock people out of the kingdom of heaven. For you do not go in yourselves, you stand at a distance critiquing everybody else. And when others are seeking to go in, you stop them. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you're hypocrites. You would cross land and sea to make a single convert to save somebody's soul, and you make a new convert twice as much a child of hell as yourself. That's pretty tough. He's pretty tough on his contemporaries. So where do we find some resolution? Where do we find relief from this, to this inevitable cycle of trying to do the right thing while at the same time not becoming self-righteous? And the answer is found in the entirety of the Gospels themselves, not just in a snippet here and there, but reading them all from beginning to end. And it spells it out time and time again. Jesus says it's by doing things like feeding the hungry, by clothing those that are naked, by healing people that are sick and diseased and brokenhearted, by lifting them up, by visiting people who are at home alone, shut in or in prison. It's in the authority also with which he speaks about God. You have heard it said, but I say to you. He does more than simply quote scripture, which his contemporaries can all do. They're brilliant scholars too, but he makes it come alive, because he is the living word. And finally, we see it in whom Jesus calls to come and follow him. This is where he really shows us what it's all about. For example, in Matthew chapter 8, verse 9, Jesus is walking along, it says, and he sees a man called Matthew sitting at a tax booth. And he says to Matthew, "Follow me." And at once, Matthew got up and followed him. Matthew is the debt collector from hell. He is like the Don Corleone man who comes to collect and break your knuckles if you don't have the money. He extorts the poor left and right. He deserves no mercy whatsoever from his audience. He is the epitome of unrighteousness. He does not do what is right in the eyes of the Lord. He got his position as a tax collector by convincing the Romans he could squeeze more money out of the poor than all the other bidders for the job. And Jesus hung out with the lots of people like this. That's the issue. Jesus hung out with them. And as he sat at dinner, it says, in the house, many tax collectors and sinners came and were sitting with him and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, in all honesty too, really, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners, man? They betray us. They betray us to the empire. And the Pharisees are right. They do get betrayed by these folks. What kind of decent person would associate with people like this? But when Jesus heard this, he said, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick, go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice, for I have come to call not the righteous, but sinners." And he's quoting here from Hosea. He's quoting from Hosea 6, verse 6. "For I desire," as Hosea puts it, "steadfast love and not sacrifice. I desire the knowledge of God rather than all the burnt offerings you could bring before me." And the right thing in Hosea's time, as it was in Jesus's time, was to get the sacrifice correct, to keep the law just right, to tithe even dill and cumin. Now, I don't know if you are a spice lover, but I am. When I do barbecue, I use all kinds of spices. Can you imagine having to count out little bits of cumin and say, well, these 9 parts are for the beef I'm going to use, and this 10th of a part is for God. Now let's go on to the coriander. These nine parts are for the brisket, and this tenth is for God. It's an undertaking of the most minute kind, and it amounts to a ridiculous amount of law-keeping just to keep God happy. Just to keep God happy. But more so, to keep happy all of those voices in our past about what it means to be a right and good person. All of the voices that have told you love is conditional. Love depends on you doing the right thing. Then I'll accept you. If you do the wrong thing, not so much. Not much has changed in the way that we as human beings have sought honor and rightness throughout the centuries, has it? It still is on us to try and follow the way of Jesus, even when we want to be Pharisees, because it's right. But God only asks, not for a right human tithe or a nice check in the offering plate, though don't get me wrong, the church always appreciates your gifts. But no, what does the Lord require? Steadfast love, which is to be pure in heart. It is to be merciful. It is to be compassionate. It is to be gentle. It is to be full of empathy. And not just for those who are the ones that obviously need it, the poor, the widow, the orphan, but for our enemies, for the people that we don't like, the people that would betray us. That's what Jesus is talking about. It's love that pulls the log out of my own eye rather than seeing the speck in my neighbor. And it releases me into a freedom from having to please others for the sake of going along to get along. I don't have to answer to others, but I do have to answer to God, just like you. Steadfast love makes goodness a fruit of the Spirit, as Paul says. It teaches us how to love people and God rather than seeking to be good by paying attention to things. Doing the right thing is always a precursor to materialism and consumerism. Doing the right thing. It gives value to things. But love, it doesn't value things. Love values people. And in so valuing people, it honors and loves God in return. So how is this call to love not just another burden? Not just another sacrifice, after all. I mean, I'm loving imperfectly. You're loving imperfectly. So how do we do this without feeling like we're not good enough again? How does the call to love not overwhelm me? Because some people are hard to love. It's work to love people that you don't always like and get along with. And you know that. If you have family, you know what I'm talking about. As Paul reminds us, love is not work, though. It's not about work. It's a gift of grace, he says. Which is a little perplexing. But when you think about the definition of a gift, what is it? A definition of a gift is something that is given to you. It is not something you have to earn or work towards. It is a present to be unwrapped and enjoyed and to be shared freely with those around you. And it becomes grace for me, and it becomes grace for you, because when I love my neighbor, like a Matthew, for example, a tax collector, I have to cut him some slack. I have to cut him a break. For love includes in its mercy the ability to see people as human, as frail and flawed, and not as perfect. It values the person despite their failings. It forgives them despite their inadequacies, and in so doing, it elevates them to a point where they can change. Nobody has ever changed because of judgment. I wish it was so, because I'd have changed so many people by now. I really would have. But I haven't, man. I have not changed hardly anybody in my life. And lucky if I've changed myself. And that's hard enough. That is hard enough work. Blessed, Jesus says, are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are you who forgive, for you will be forgiven. It's in our self-interest to do this. And as I learn to forgive my neighbor, I have found I can forgive myself for not being perfect, for not living up to the standards that my family set for me, so to speak, for not living up to the expectations that I inherited. And then I doubled down on myself and said, I can do better. I know it. And the more I tried to get to be better and better, the harder it came. It was like trying to hold on to water. It just slips through your fingers. And when that happens, when you suddenly realize that you can love yourself and you can love a Matthew who's a tax collector, then suddenly you become salt. You become flavoring. You become something that adds something to life. And you become light again. You become something that reveals who God is, both to your family and to your friends. For the simple reason that I'm not trying to change them anymore, but simply trying the best of my ability to love them as I try to love myself. Imperfect as I am, and as perfect, imperfect as you are as well. Thank God for forgiveness, because we all need it. We just don't always acknowledge it. Amen.